By most measures, the first 100 days of President Donald Trump's second term are like nothing we've seen in modern history, marked by deep cuts, high tariffs, and mass deportations. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanara joins me in this recorded interview to talk about the first few months of this second Trump term and the threat of funding cuts to public media, including NPR. Domenico Montanaro, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So President Trump marks his 100th day in office next week. How would you characterize just how unusual or historic the first 100 days of this term have been?
Well, it's been very aggressive, obviously, in trying to get a lot done through executive orders. More than 130 executive orders have been signed. Really not very much legislation that's been signed. And ordinarily, a president will use a lot of political capital on trying to get one major piece of legislation done in their first 6 months or so. And Trump has really tried to do as much as possible around Congress. And he has, you know, a lot of the levers of power in Washington. You know, he comes in with a Republican controlled Congress. He has a 6-3 conservative majority at the Supreme Court with three justices that he appointed in his first term. So certainly a very different place that Trump starts out for his second term than he did in his first term when he was really a political novice.
How different is his approach to executive power than past presidents?
It's uniquely different. I mean, he's trying everything he possibly can to consolidate power and loyalty as much as possible. You know, anybody who kind of speaks out against him, anyone who doesn't show fealty, and they would say people who are not promoting the agenda of the president, people they see as the, quote, deep state, people who they think would be trying to stop his agenda, you know, he's really trying to oust them. And, you know, that is different than we've seen, you know, with past presidents. We've seen some past presidents try to bring in people of different mindsets, the quote-unquote team of rivals that historian Doris Kearns Goodwin talked about in Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. She sort of applied that to Barack Obama's cabinet as well, because you remember Barack Obama brought in Republicans to be, transportation secretary, and Ray LaHood from Illinois, Bob Gates at the Defense Department. So he really tried to show that he was bringing in Republicans to try to show a kind of bridge to the other side to have differing points of view. That's not really something Trump wants or engages in. What he has surrounded himself with are people who believe very much in what he's doing, and they're trying as hard as they can to be able to take down the pieces of government that they see as things that are, we're promoting a liberal agenda and not promoting something that's more conservative.
President Trump talked a lot about tariffs during the campaign, but his administration's policies on tariffs have been kind of on again, off again. What are the politics at play with these decisions he's making when it comes to tariffs?
Well, he's really now started to get affected in his approval ratings. We're seeing him in the 40s again for his approval ratings, and even worse on the economy, in the 30s when it comes to his handling of the economy and his handling of tariffs. There were just a slew of polls out this week showing that. And it's really an inverse of his first term. You know, his first term, he had lower overall approval ratings, but higher economic approval ratings. And a lot of why people who may have crossed over to vote for Trump, voted for him thinking about that nostalgia of his first term, the pre-COVID economy up till about 2019, in thinking that, he might be able to lower prices because they were upset with inflation, when really all the experts say that his tariffs will have the opposite effect. And that's why we've seen so much volatility in the stock market and his own policies on this and why he's changed. People would say that he has been chaotic. He calls it being flexible. And that, though, has caused a real decline in the stock market and a lot of, jumps and downturns.
You just referred to that volatility in the market, the jumps, the downturns. Does the president seem to be responding to all those market fluctuations? And any idea who's profiting from those fluctuations?
Yeah, he doesn't seem to care much about public opinion in the second term. He doesn't have to run for anything again, even though he's teased running for a third term, even though he's constitutionally barred from doing so. But he does seem to be responsive to the stock market. And he has a lot of billionaires in his cabinet, very wealthy people, like the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who has told him that, you know, the market is not liking some of these policies, despite the people that Trump wants to listen to, like his trade advisor, Peter Navarro. You know, and Trump has long held this belief that tariffs are a sort of panacea for the country. He was talking about this stuff in the 1980s. You can have almost exactly the same language from back then that you could apply to today. The problem with using that kind of strict ideology is it doesn't necessarily always fit the time and the economic circumstances of that time. So there are, you know, I don't know about who's profiting exactly at this point. I mean, there have been allegations of potential stock trades, the timing of those trades, which people are investigating and looking into. And of course, there's Elon Musk, who has been there with Trump, sort of pushing to, you know, to make the government smaller, firing, you know, thousands of federal workers in really very, you know, blunt ways that have not really provided much easy off-ramp for a lot of those folks or those agencies. And there's questions around Elon Musk and what he could be benefiting from or not benefiting from when it comes to his government contracts. Of course, this week he also said that he's going to be taking a step back from DOGE, his informal Department of Government Energy, Department of Government Efficiency, rather, at the end of probably next month when this informal 100-day advisory role position sort of expires. And that's directly related to the fact that Tesla has seen a 71% drop in its profit.
I'm talking in this recorded interview with NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro about the first 100 days of President Trump's second term. Let's shift to immigration. How different is President Trump's approach to immigration this term from how different is it from previous administrations and from his first term in office?
You know, he talked a big talk on immigration his first term, and he really was focused on building the wall, if you remember that, right? There's been less talk about building the wall and much more talk about just deporting people and getting them out, you know, extrajudiciously around the courts. And, you know, trying to find ways to be able to do that, whether it's through invoking, you know, the Alien Enemies Act or state secrets acts, you know, these sort of reaching deep into the playbook, you know, into the law book to try to figure out ways where they don't need to listen to lower courts in particular. I think we would near a constitutional crisis if and when he decides not to follow a Supreme Court order that tells him to do something explicitly. Of course, there was the order to bring back the one person who's been living in Maryland, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, and the court told them to facilitate their return, but they also contradicted themselves in saying that the lower courts also need to respect the authority of a president conducting foreign policy. And that gave the Trump administration the opening to say, well, we can't tell El Salvador what to do. And if they want to bring them back, then we'll provide a plane. And of course, they're sort of winking and nodding to each other and saying they're not going to do it. Neither of them wants to do it. So that's sort of what we're seeing this time around. Last time, if you remember, there were the travel bans, you know, the so-called Muslim travel ban from back then, where banned people from countries that are predominantly Muslim in many cases. We haven't seen that as much this time. This time it's been focused on trying to get people out of the country in any way they possibly can. And they have the support, certainly, of Republicans in Congress. And they have, a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court majority that's more friendly to him this time than in his first term. Certainly very unusual for any past presidents. Past presidents might have talked about, you know, the need for comprehensive immigration overhaul. It's one thing I was thinking about this past week when he said that we can't give due process to all of these folks because there's too many folks here and there aren't enough judges. Well, that's been the point of these pushes over the last 20 years for comprehensive immigration overhaul, and doesn't appear to be something that Trump is really interested in doing.
You mentioned Kilmer Obrega-Garcia, and his case has gotten a lot of attention. This man who is living in Maryland, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, that some members of the administration said it was an error that he was deported. Walk us through the legal and political pushback the administration has gotten over this case in particular, and talk a little bit more about how the president has responded to all that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there have been some Republicans who've talked out in saying that this was a mistake, that he shouldn't have been deported. His own Justice Department said that he was mistakenly deported. And the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, was very upset with the lawyer who was making the case for the administration in court. And he had said this in court and was dismissed from this case altogether because was seen as not promoting the case that the president wanted. So he had been deported, and even though he's been living in Maryland for years, came to the country when he was 16 years old, was being recruited by gangs, the Washington Post had reported, in El Salvador. His parents didn't want him caught up in that, so sent him to the United States. He crossed the border illegally, has been in the United States, doesn't have a criminal record. In 2019, he had been picked up at a Home Depot with some other folks in the parking lot. They're late looking for work, they said, in construction, the work that he's been doing. And he was rounded up, and based on some of his tattoos that he had, the police in Maryland and Prince George's County determined that they felt he was part of MS-13, the gang that operates in the United States and mostly from El Salvador. You know, and his lawyer says he is not part of the gang. His wife has asked for his return. His wife is an American citizen. He's had legal status in the United States. There was a domestic abuse allegations against him as well. There was a restraining order that his wife had put in for and then didn't continue to press charges. She said she had been in an abusive relationship previously and pulled back on this. So there's a lot of gray area here on what kind of person he is and whether or not he's been part of a gang or what he's been doing. But the fact is he has no criminal record in the United States, and he was never put through any due process to show whether he was part of any gang. And the judge who heard this case said that she felt that the evidence against him was flimsy anyway. And that was said that they wanted to have him brought back to the country. And obviously the Trump administration has said no. So it's been very messy. The Trump administration feels like they can make an easy, visceral case that he's a, quote, criminal, and criminals should be deported. It's sometimes a lot harder for Democrats to make a case that's about due process because it's seen as kind of esoteric and complicated and nuanced, and politics certainly doesn't lend itself to nuance very well.
Well, there are hundreds of other people the Trump administration has deported. How much evidence has the administration provided that everybody who's been deported has committed crimes in this country? Or is the idea that if a person is here without proper authorization, that that's enough of a crime to be deported?
Yeah, and that's something that White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt had said initially at the very beginning when she was pressed on this, very close to the beginning of the Trump administration here as we reach the 100 days, that just because they cross the border makes them a criminal, period. So anybody who gets deported who didn't have permanent legal status, then sort of the message is too bad. And I think that part of that reasoning from the Trump administration is to scare people off from coming to the country, to say that you could be deported if you're here and you don't have permanent legal status. If you're not a citizen, you could be deported. And we've even heard Trump try to make the muse about with the Salvadoran president that he would want to deport homegrown criminals, American citizens who have committed crimes and sent to prisons in El Salvador, which would certainly be illegal. So not a lot of evidence has been used in courts to justify the removal of people, but they don't feel like they need to.
We'll continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, we'll hear about a new documentary that explores the role of public libraries. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back in this recorded conversation about the first 100 days of President Trump's second term. My guest is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Let's talk about Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. NPR reported this week that the White House is looking to replace him after a second controversy concerning information he shared in a Signal group chat. I want to note NPR CEO Catherine Meyer is chair of the board of directors at the Signal Foundation. Is it possible we could see a cabinet shakeup before the first 100 days of this term is over?
I think it's unlikely that we'll see something, you know, by Wednesday of next week, by the end of the 100 days, that Hegseth would be out. I mean, what we've seen so far is the administration very much digging in to support Hegseth. We've heard the president himself, you know, the press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, again, saying that he has confidence, saying that these reports about the White House looking for someone else, all of the other things that have been alleged about Hegseth, you know, whether it's his wife, Jennifer, getting putting in papers for security clearances, as CNN had reported, or a whole host of other things. They just call it fake news. Hegseth himself has said that there are anonymous people who are against him in the entire Pentagon. And Caroline Leavitt had said the entire Pentagon seems out to get him, even though it's not all been anonymous. There have been people who worked for him and were close to him who put their names on op-eds saying that it's been a month of chaos. So, you know, it's not unusual that a White House would be looking into who they might replace somebody with if they're starting to get into some political hot water. You know, it's not unusual that they would replace somebody. It is unusual this early to be talking about it as a possibility. So I do think that there's the potential that he's out. At this point, the White House is saying that they're standing behind him.
Well, this confirmation hearing for Pete Hegseth was pretty spicy. I mean, members of Congress raised questions about his qualifications for the job. Are some of those members of Congress now saying, hey, we kind of saw this coming, or we should have seen this coming?
You know, it's hard to get members of Congress on the record to say that they think that this was a mistake, that they voted for a mistake or made a problem. But we've heard from people like Don Bacon, who's a moderate Republican from Nebraska, in a district, by the way, that Kamala Harris won, a Democrat in the 2024 presidential election, say that that Hegseth should essentially be out, that he wouldn't tolerate some of the behavior that he's seen. But again, he's a very rare person in Congress, because we've seen so much polarization over the years where we have far fewer swing districts in this country than we ever did before. I mean, there's only a few dozen that are really considered districts that could go in either direction. And because of that, there's no incentive for people to speak out to say that they want someone out and go against the president if they're in a Republican district. And most of these districts where Republicans are in right now are pretty heavily Republican and heavily voted for Trump. So they feel politically that it would be a problem for them if they were to speak out against President Trump. And that's why you see somebody like Bacon or someone like Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, who said that she fears retribution for speaking out. But again, she's been tested. She's somebody with the last name Murkowski. It's a famous name in the state. Conservatives tried to push her out. She won an independent write-in bid in a statewide senatorial contest, which is almost unheard of. So she has a lot of credibility to be able to do this. But there are fewer and fewer of those kinds of people in Congress just based on the kinds of districts and where they come from.
I also want to ask you about a Trump administration push that hits close to home, and that's the push to defund public media, which includes NPR. Here is NPR CEO Catherine Meyer talking to Mary Louise Kelly about the importance of public funding.
I actually think public funding ensures that we hold tight to a mission that reigns reflecting all Americans. Most commercial outlets are able to target certain audiences that they want to reach. We have an actual obligation in our mission and in our funding model to try to serve everyone across the country. Now, we won't always be able to serve everyone, every belief set, every need, every interest, but we need to serve as broad an audience as possible. That's the point of public broadcasting, is to be able to put the public in conversation with one another and to operate off a shared set of conversations about what's going on in the world.
What's behind this push to defund public media, and how politically popular is the idea?
Well, there was a poll out earlier this month from the Pew Research Center that found that 43% of people support continuing public funding. Only 24% said that they do not support continuing public funding for public media. 33% were undecided about that. And I think that that's an important thing, because in politics, when there are people who are undecided, then the messaging becomes really important just from a political standpoint. You know, how the argument is made and how the argument is framed for why public media should continue to get funding. And, you know, one argument, as Catherine Marr made there, is that it is in its charter to be able to serve all voices. And I think that we do really try our best. I certainly know I do, and the Washington desk tries to, you know, be able to have the strongest argument from all sides of a story in the piece that you're working on. And I think that one of the reasons I got involved in public media is because I've always sort of revered the amount of time and depth and thought that goes into the stories that are done that are different than what we see on, you know, some of the commercial broadcast outlets. And I love places like NBC, ABC, and CBS. I used to work at all of them. And but a lot of the pieces that get done are, you know, for if you were to watch nightly news on NBC, minute 15 to minute 45 packages. And they only have 22 minutes or so to be able to get all of that out there. And we have a different mission. And I'm proud of the work that we've done. I mean, being able to do, it's funny, you know, we'll say sometimes, I don't know how I'm going to get all this done in 4 minutes. And then I think back to my days at NBC, and I'm just like, that's almost four times the amount of time that you get at a broadcast outlet. And I think that that's an important thing to realize for people who, you know, might not understand why continuing public funding is important. You know, when you're strictly reliant on commercial, you know, advertising, it makes it harder to be able to say that we're going to engage in this mission of public service to have all sides in a story. And look, we're not perfect. Not everything that gets done, not every story that gets done, people are going to be happy with or going to be reflective. But what I know of people who work here and the work that we do is that we are operating in good faith. And if we make a mistake, we correct it. And we're open to all points of view. And I think that that's an important thing for all of us in life to be that way. And there's just far too many people right now who are dug in on their own perspectives of how things should go without being open to changing their minds based on evidence.
I know the funding of NPR is not your job, but what would the loss of all federal funding mean to NPR? I've seen quotes from Catherine Marr that it would be worse for member stations than the network.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated funding structure, and I don't want to speak out of school because it's not my my role. But I certainly any kind of public funding, you know, will go more immediately to the stations because the stations pay for the content that NPR provides, and the stations are distributing the content that the headquarters, that the network provides, you know, on the content that you hear on All Things Considered or Morning Edition. And, you know, a lot of the stations around the country, especially when you look at how local news has been so decimated. And that's a place where I started my career at a fairly large paper in suburban New Jersey outside New York City. And, you know, even that newspaper, when I worked there, there were 175 positions in the paper that were dark. In other words, they weren't going to be hiring people who had left. So that it was just shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And public media has an opportunity to be able to fill some of the gaps, to have real important dedicated local news coverage with some seriousness and some depth. In places, in parts of the country that, you know, you don't always get even a broadcast signal or any other commercial radio or TV that is dedicated to those areas. And I think that that's a really important part of the mission. And those kind of rural stations that are most reliant on government funding are the ones that would be most impacted. And frankly, in a lot of those areas, they tend to be conservative red areas when you look at the political map. And those are the places that seem to be most likely to be affected and impacted by this, but we'll all be impacted by it. And it, you know, and I just know that the work that we do is vital. And, you know, we really work hard to try to get as much, you know, in the public interest on the airwaves. And I think that it's critical, and it's been a huge public service. And I hope that it continues.
Well, I certainly listen to your work a lot, and I am a regular listener to the NPR Politics podcast. And at the risk at the risk of stepping on that podcast toes, I wanted to ask if you would share a Can't Let It Go for this week.
Oh, wow.
What have you been thinking about? Is there anything on your mind that you can't stop thinking about, that you can't let go, whether it's political or something else?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a Mets fan. I'm from Queens. I grew up 2 miles from the stadium. I could see the glow of the lights from my house. So people who listen to the podcast know that I'm a Mets fan, a baseball fan. And it's just been really nice to watch them actually do well for once in my life, given that they haven't won a World Series since 1986, as most people probably know. And we're always the sort of butt of Yankees fans' jokes, like my dad and my brother. So I'm very happy to see that they're 18-7 and have the best record in baseball at this point of this recording. So I will take what I can get. And that's right now what I can't let go of.
That is a very strong response in Cincinnati Reds country. So,
well, hey, you know, I like our owner. I don't know how you guys feel about yours.
Well, I've been talking with NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, you're welcome. Great to speak with you.
Up next, a new documentary explores the history and importance of the nation's public libraries. This is Cincinnati Edition.